Hi, and welcome back to Dedication. Fans, remember the Bay City Rollers. Thank you for joining us for the second part of our conversation with the Bay City Rollers' original lead singer, Nobby Clark. If you haven't listened to part one, we do encourage you to do that first, obviously. So let's pick up where we left off.
It went on from there because in America, what happened was that Clive Davis, the head of Arista Records, he heard Saturday Night, and he decided that because they had the opportunity to because he not only did he hear Saturday Night, but he also heard the Bay City Rollers version of Bye Bye Baby, mm-hmm. which, by the way, we used to do as a live song when I was with the group. It was a very popular song. It wasn't that well known here. The original wasn't that well known here because it was done by Four Seasons.
Right.
But it was a song that Alan and I loved, and we decided to introduce it into the live set that we did. And so Clive Davis had the two different recordings, and some wise man had said that, you can't do Bye Bye Baby because it's already been a hit in America by the Four Seasons.
Yeah.
And so the other song they had of the Rollers was Saturday Night. Clive Davis thought, this is going to be massive here, you know, because of the chant, S-A-T-U-R-D-Y. Yeah. It was right at the beginning of the football season.
Mm.
And he decided to release it, not knowing I had left the group.
Oh, wow.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, it was unbelievable, you know. The trouble is, they were all trying to cover up. They were all trying to make out that Les McKeown was the singer in the group and did all these songs. So there's a big cover-up going on. So nobody in America knew, because they were all trying to pretend it wasn't happening.
Sure.
And Davis was never told that I'd left the band.
Oh, wow.
So he released it with my voice on it. It was played in all the football stadiums across America. It was massive. All the radio stations were playing it and everything, and it just went zoom right up the charts.
Certainly did.
So, a phone call from Alan saying, he was in America at the time with the group, and he phoned me from America to say, you better get your lawyer onto this because it's gone to number one with your voice on it.
Wow. So the song we heard was actually you singing it.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. So somewhere after it got to that point in the Billboard Hot 100, they decided that they better very quickly try and re-record with Les's voice, you know. So the same backing track, all my backing voices are still on there, everything. They just changed the lead voice on it.
So what we were hearing on the radio wasn't the record yet. It was just whatever they sent. When we went and bought the album after the Howard Cosell show, was
yes.
it a different recording at that point, once it was pressed?
That was after it had been a hit, and Les McKeown's voice was put on it.
Oh, yeah. I see. But
yeah.
The very beginning stages, the radio station's playing your voice, and it went to number one.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, and the thing was, you see, what they tried to do after that was, they tried to dupe the public into believing that it was Les McKeown's voice on there. Because he sounded a little bit similar to me, and that's what happens, you know, that's the truth of it.
Wow.
And of course, when we got to the court case later on, in years, I don't know if we can jump to this, but we got to the court case in New York to try and recover unpaid royalties. They were all under oath. The depositions, they were all under oath, and they were presented with 26 albums, all released with my vocals on, and I wasn't paid any money for it at all, and they all had to admit it was my voice on all these songs.
Oh, wow.
And I'm not talking about the hit songs, I'm talking about all the other songs that I recorded with the group over these years that were all put out on albums.
Yeah, all the compilations that came out later.
All there. And they all had to admit under oath that it was my voice on all these songs. So that was really upsetting, you know.
Absolutely. I do love music, but I do hate the business of it. I really do.
Yeah. Well, it was really unfortunate that I was never ever to during that court case, which went on for 6 years, by the way.
Yeah.
Before we got to the stage where it was just going to go to court, we were at the deposition stage, and the sad thing about it was that I was never out to do anything to harm that group. Never. It was never my intention. My intention was to get the record company to pay me for using my vocal performances and selling millions and millions of copies, you know?
That doesn't sound unreasonable at all, does it?
What was that? Sorry.
That doesn't sound unreasonable at all.
Well, no. I thought it was very reasonable. Mm. And but what I came up against was the resistance by the group to recognize that I should be included in any royalties that are recovered. And so they decided, between them all and their lawyers, to file a motion to have me dismissed from the case on the statute of limitations. I know this is going to get a bit political here, and we don't want to really go down that road, but it's part of the story. And they filed a motion to have me dismissed from the case, which the judge upheld. And then later on, the record company's lawyers decided, well, the way to get at the group now is, because they've set a precedence, we'll file a motion to have them dismissed from the case on the statute of limitations. And the judge had no choice but to uphold it.
Wow.
It was ludicrous.
So they didn't deny it was you on the records. They just wanted you out of the court case by doing this.
It's all recorded. All the depositions were filmed and recorded in front of all the legal eagles. It's all there. It's all recorded legally.
So that kind of backfired on them.
It backfired on them, and it was all because of greed.
Yeah.
So silly. So silly. But that's done now. So, you know, just I've mentioned it because it's part of the... It's part of the whole story, you know.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some other things. In your book, you go into great detail not only about your time with the band, but also your efforts to pursue a solo career. Tell us a little bit about your challenges and successes. And if you don't mind, this wasn't part of our pre-interview, but I loved reading about your adventure with Alan when you went to Sky. And poetry, Laura and I were just there last year, so I could really visualize all that. So if you want to tell us a little bit about that, we'd love to hear it.
Mm. Oh, it was a fantastic time. I mean, how that came about was that Alan had come out of the group. He was out for about a year, you know. Mm. Again, it was to do with the pressures put upon them by Tom Payton. And the infighting in the group, you know, it was at the stage where Les McKeown wouldn't share a dressing room with the rest of the band. He was demanding his own suite in a different hotel, and he wouldn't go in the same cars with them. He was very special, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And it was all that. And the infighting got so great that Alan thought, I just can't do this anymore. And he came out of the group. His intention was not to go back, but they had so many problems with, because that was the time that Ian Mitchell and Pat McGlynn had joined one after the other.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There was a few problems with that. And so they came back to Alan and asked him if he would rejoin the band, you know. But he'd been out for, I mean, it was close on 9 months to a year. And we spent a lot of time together. Up in Scotland and in Glendevin and Dollar, where Alan lived, you know.
Yeah.
We used to go up to this big castle up in Glendevin, and we spent a lot of time there. It was fantastic. Mm. What a wonderful time we had. But the trouble is that Alan hadn't been doing very much, and he had put on a bit of weight. And I said to him, Alan, you can't go back into the group like that. You need to get yourself fit, get trimmed up, you know. And I came up with a stupid idea, and it was a stupid idea to begin with, because I didn't for 1 minute think that we would do it. It was just in a silly conversation. I said, you know, we should just go and hitchhike to Skye. you know. And, and Alan said, okay, let's do it. And I thought, how are we going to do that, you know? Anyway, however, what we did was we sort of, over a period of a couple of weeks before we actually started to do it, was we didn't shave, we just grew beards, or what part of beards. And we got the walking boots, and we got all the weather clothing, you know, and off we went with our rucksacks. We parked the car up in Fort William, left it there, and headed off. And it was wonderful. It was really wonderful. We had just a fantastic adventure. We slept in a tent. We just had a wonderful, wonderful time. And we hitchhiked all the way up through Skye. We met some beautiful people. And if you've been there, you'll know what the atmosphere is like. Oh, it's just a fabulous.
It's beautiful.
It really is stunning, isn't it? Stunning.
What kind of miles did you cover?
Well, all the way, we went from Fort William over to Mallaig to get the boat across, because there was no bridge at that time over to Skye. So we hitchhiked right up to there to Mallaig, got the boat over to Skye. Then we hitchhiked right up through the island of Skye to the top end, got the boat across to the next island up, which is Harris. And we got from the base of Harris all the way up through the island of Harris, through Lewis, the Isle of Lewis, all the way up to Stornoway, right to the top.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was just amazing. We had such a fantastic time. And, you know, the thing about it was, you know, we were so close that we recognized when each one of us was getting too tired or was in pain because there was blisters on your feet, or, you know, that your legs were sore and you couldn't walk any further. And so we were looking out for each other, you know. It was just a wonderful, wonderful adventure and a wonderful tight friendship, you know, that I'll never forget.
Yeah.
And Alan and I were so close, we could tell each other anything. You know, we knew everything there was to know about each other, you know. We were that close as friends, you know. And doing that trip was the most wonderful thing. I will never ever forget it. And I've got one photograph of us from Stornoway back across to the mainland, and we had got cleaned up, and we'd had a quick shave and everything, you know. And I've got one photograph of him and I on the boat coming back over, and it's a fabulous photograph, you know. And it just kind of sums up that trip. And and then, of course, when we got back, Alan went back to the group, and he stayed with them for quite a while after that, you know. Unfortunately, their success had peaked, and it was going over the other side, you know.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. For sure. We were getting older, and definitely. Well, tell us about, you know, some of your challenges and successes when you were going to pursue your solo career.
Yeah. Well, again, it was an adventure. You know, it was something new for me. I didn't know where it was going to go. I just knew that here I was, all of a sudden, after all these years, under that strict regime of Tam Peyton, and this very tight-knit setup that we had, you know. We just communicated with each other. Very few other people were allowed into it, you know. And all of a sudden, I left the group, and I was kind of lost for a while because I was so used to having these people with me.
Your brothers in arms.
And it was, exactly. It was quite a scary time, actually, to begin with. And because of the success of the group, I had these record companies wanting to sign me up. And eventually we settled on one, and we got the contract signed and all that stuff. And I worked with a guy that introduced me to a guy called Mike Smith. Mike was a wonderful guy. He had a lot of success with various groups. He had worked with the Fortunes, he'd worked Oh, he produced Yellow River, Obladi Oblada for the Marmalade, oh, an endless string. I mean, he was the first guy that went to Liverpool to see the Beatles.
Oh, wow.
Because he was working for Decca at the time. And he was sent up to see this band called the Beatles, you know. And he decided to go for another group called Brian Poole and the Tremolos. And took them over the Beatles, you know. And
that was always his
big story. That was always his big story, you know. The biggest mistake he ever made, you know.
Oopsies.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But he used to laugh about it, you know, because he did have a lot of success. The Tremolos, without Brian Poole, by the way, they went on to have a string of hits which Mike produced for them. I mean, Silence is Golden, you'll know all these songs. He produced all of these, and he was a wonderful guy, a wonderful producer. Anyway, they put me together with Mike, and I recorded my first solo stuff, and they released on the CBS label. They put me on, I was on CBS, but it was on the Epic label, and it was my first single called Steady Love. And Steady Love was very successful for me, and as much as that, we started off right away. We got the power play on Radio Luxembourg, which then, you know, it sparked off other interest in all that stuff. So yeah, it was good. It was a hit in other countries, not so big here, but did very well in Europe. And that, again, it led on to other things, because through that and the next single to follow, which was Shake It Down, I was introduced to Claude Francois in Paris, and Claude Francois was being looked after in Britain, in the UK, by the same team that were looking after me. So, and Claude Francois was a huge artist. He had his own television show in France and Paris, and he was huge in North America and Canada and all over the place. But he was French speaking, you know. And I don't know if many people know this. Some people do, some people don't. But he wrote My Way.
Oh, wow.
He wrote the original version of My Way was written in French. It was Comme de Habitude. It was I Did It Through Habit. What happened was that this beautiful in French, it's beautiful. He wrote the melody, he wrote the French lyrics, and Paul Anka eventually got all the credit because he translated it from I Did It Through Habit to I Did It My Way. So
he
Yeah, well, he took the credit for writing that song, and all he did was, okay, he added a few lyrics, but he just translated the French into English, you know.
Wow.
And also part of the story is that it was also sent to David Bowie's publishers to see if David Bowie would write English lyrics for the song, and it was rejected because it was apparently turned out to be a lot of rubbish. But
the rest is history.
There you go. So anyway, I through all that, I ended up being invited on to Claude Francois's Christmas special in Paris, where I performed Shake It Down, which was the next single, and unfortunately my time in life has never been great, but not long after that show, Claude Francois died through electrocution. He was having a bath and the light went out and he went up, touched the light fitting and electrocuted himself and died. So, yeah. And I was already booked to do another four or five television shows with him.
Oh.
Unfortunately, all went astray. Oh. But I mean, he was such a big artist, such a huge artist in France, that the whole of France shut down for a whole day or 2 days, I think it was, or something, because he was such a loss to the French people, you know.
Oh, wow.
I mean, he was absolutely massive. And on that show, that Christmas special I did, there was a lot of quite famous European artists, but Jodie Foster was also on that show.
Oh, Oh my goodness.
Yeah, she was very young there then, and she had her parents traveling with her. And we sang at the beginning of the show as an introduction to who was on the show. They got one or two of us to sing together, and we did I'm Just a Daydreamer together. Jodie Foster.
Oh, that's awesome.
Is there footage of this
anywhere?
Sorry?
Is there footage of this anywhere? Like on YouTube or anything?
Yeah, there is. There is. I've got part of the show, but I think you can get it. You have to search for it.
Yeah, we definitely will.
We should look for that on YouTube.
Because Francois, he obviously passed away, and so all of his stuff was quite treasured, so it's quite hard to get a hold of stuff, but it's around.
I mean, really, if that didn't happen and you were continued on his show, you could have just lived in Paris for the rest of your life and been a huge star. That would have been a nice life. I wouldn't.
But
mind
it was
that.
All it's all part of the journey, isn't it? I mean,
it is.
I remember just before we did that. In fact, I'll tell you what it was. We did the first show, which was a Christmas special. And in between that and the accident, Claude Francois came over to London, and I was in London at the same time, and Paul Anka was playing at the Albert Hall. And Claude Francois wanted to go along to see him, so my manager, Charles Armitage, and myself, Claude Francois, and two other people, we went along to the Albert Hall. We were sitting away up in the balcony, and he came on stage, and Paul Anka said, I'm going to sing a song now that I wrote for Frank Sinatra. It's called My Way.
Uh-oh.
And Claude Francois just got up and walked out.
There you go. Too right, too right.
Yeah, absolutely. And I supported him in that. There you go. But, no, it was interesting. See, that's all part of the journey. And I don't talk about these people's their names and things to be smart. I just love it.
It's your story.
I love the whole thing, and when I tell these stories to people, and in my book and all that stuff, I'm putting across this, that music industry doesn't exist anymore.
Everyone is lawyered up. They're lawyered up from day one now, aren't they?
Yeah. It's all gone. It's all gone.
Yeah.
And there's one or two quite large record companies left, but it's again they're restructured, it's different. But what I experienced in my time as a young man was in London, the excitement of the whole artistry of the whole thing, and every corner there was a recording studio or a record company or a publishing company, or you know, it was all there.
Yeah.
And when you got signed to a record company, it was everything was there. It was there was the publicity department, there was the A&R department, there was the photography department, there was everything, you know.
Yeah.
And and they took you and they guided you and took you on to the next stage and all that stuff. It was very, very exciting. I know there's, I know Simon Cowell has something going on similar, but the reason I'm saying it is unfortunate, a lot of young artists will never get to experience that.
Oh, that's absolutely right.
Yeah,
there's
and it's been a whole, it's just been an adventure from start to finish, you know?
Yeah, there's an artist called Francis Dunnery, I'm not sure if you know who he is, but he does something that's kind of like that, it's a co-op, you come, he does everything with you, produces you, and then you're part of the team for the next person, so it's like you pay it forward, he pays it forward, and you pay it back. It's kind of an interesting way to do things.
Right.
But yeah,
that sounds good. Yeah.
Yeah, he does some good work.
Yeah, does he write as well?
He writes
songs.
I believe he's Scottish. Right. I think he is Scottish too. I'll have to send you a link to him. I think you'd like him very much.
Yes, please. Yes, I'd like to follow it up. Yeah.
Okay. You mentioned also in your book that later you were producing music with, I think, Mike Hood.
Mm-hmm.
And
you
had famous musicians coming in and out of your studio all the time, and at one point even the Bay City Rollers. Do you remember that, and do you remember why they were there and the lineup?
I do remember it, and And I remember Mike was, well, Mike used to look after, we had a lot of rehearsal rooms, and Mike used to look after the rehearsal rooms, and I took care of the studio. And so we had a lot of people coming and going, and the good thing about it was a lot of the groups who were going on tour or anything would come in and they would rehearse their new stuff. And then they would come into the studio and record it. You know, we had bands like Simple Minds and various other people coming through and recording their early stuff. And and I remember Billy McKenzie with Associates. They were very big over here. Billy used to come in and do all his original stuff there. And so it was just a great atmosphere, you know, for being creative. And so we had this one big hall, big room, that we hadn't really been using because it wasn't developed yet, you know, because the soundproofing wasn't done and all that kind of stuff. But we got a call, the Bay City Rollers wanted to rehearse. Did we have a place big enough? And Mike said, well, we could put them in the big room. And I said, well, you know, they're going to be loud. There could be a noise problem, you know, which there was in the end. But yeah, I said, okay, I'll be scarce. I said, but you can get on with it, you know. And then they came, and they and I was there actually. I did see them and I did chat to them. And then they rehearsed their show for their tour. And it was all very nice, you know. It was all very nice. I didn't speak to Les very much. I mean, I think we've only ever had two conversations in our entire life, and they were both very short. So, yeah.
Well, you have remained friends with Dave Patton, and he's gone on to produce some of your records. Tell us about that.
Well, Davey, yes, Davey Patton. Yeah, well, Davey and I are very, very close friends. Again, we've stayed friends since really way back when Davey came into the group. In fact, I've known Davey since way back when he played with the Beachcombers, and I mean, we're talking about 1965, 66, way back then. That's when we first met. Then he joined the group, joined the Rollers. Davey was a great influence on the band, honestly, musically. Along with Billy Lyle too, who came into the group, and they both went on to have great success with Pilot. But Davey and I, we've been very close, and I had been writing some stuff. I sort of came out of the music business for a while, you know. I was pretty mixed up in my life, things weren't going too well, and but I just had these songs that were whirling around my head, and I started to put them down as demos, and I played them to Davey, and Davey said, you should really do an album. And I remember sort of saying to him that, but they're not written, they weren't written for that reason, you know. It was like therapy to me. I was talking about things that were really on my mind and bothering me, you know. And but he said, no, you should record them. So I did, and I did the very first one. The very first album I did with Davey, and it was no intention of making it available to anybody. But it got such an amazing reaction that I didn't get pushed into making it available, but you know, people said to me, you should, and I did. So I put that out, and then I followed it up with another two albums that Davey produced as well, and I'm really, really pleased with them. You know, they're different. They're very different. I'm not saying that they're particularly commercial, but if you want to hear heartfelt songs, heartfelt lyrics, and nice melodic music and all that stuff, then you can have a listen.
Yeah, no, we definitely were listening, and I felt like you had like a Jerry Rafferty vibe. I think they are heartfelt, and they're your story.
Yes, that's right. That's what it's about, really. It was a release for me, I suppose, at the time. I was pretty mixed up, and I think it helped me to try and clear things out of my head, you know.
It's cathartic.
Absolutely. But as I say, they weren't written for any commercial reason. You know, I wasn't trying to write pop songs or anything. I was just writing stuff that was coming out at the time, and that's how it happened, really. I wasn't intending to make them any commercial success out of it at all, you know.
Well, sometimes the best things we do for ourselves.
It's kind of created a cult following for me, you know.
Nothing wrong with that.
That's a great byproduct.
That's all, yeah. Sorry, what was that question? Did I have something there?
Oh, I might have forgotten. who inspires you today, and who are you listening to?
Well, you know, there's a lot of really quite poor music around, and there's a lot of brilliant music around.
Agree.
I think, well, it's only my opinion, for what it's worth, but there's a lot of young artists churning out stuff that sounds like everything you've ever heard before. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of creativity involved. It's more like plagiarism, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm not that keen on that stuff. But what I do like is some of the artists who are really coming up with some great stuff. And I'm talking about Louis Capaldi.
Okay.
Is he big in America?
He has a following here, yes. I'm aware of him.
Yeah, I think he's brilliant, and some of the other people, Billie Eilish, I love.
You do?
Billie
Eilish. Oh, wow.
I love it because of my granddaughter, who's 9 years old. She's crazy about her. And my own daughter, Sarah, she loves it too, loves her music. And I'm really into sort of Japanese stuff just now.
Oh, tell me about Japanese that.
Well, it's quite unusual stuff. It's very electronic stuff, you know. Mm. And again, I've been introduced to it through my granddaughter, Mia, who's 9. She listens to a lot of that stuff, and where she finds it, I don't know, but I love it. She's into lots of Japanese stuff. And Ellie Goulding, of course. Ellie Goulding.
Of course. And you do mention... You do mention Lucinda Williams in your book, so you got a million points from me on that.
What was that, sorry?
You mentioned Lucinda Williams in your book, and you get a million points. A million points,
yeah.
For that. I love her.
Oh, of course. I know you're a big fan.
I am.
And Jackson Browne, of course, I've always been a big fan of. And
I
love his music. See, there's a time for that type of music, you know?
Oh, for sure.
And it's fine, you're a bit melancholy, but it's lovely. If you're into poetry, and you have to listen to Jackson Browne, because his lyrics are just stunning.
And some of the songs he wrote, he was so young. It's like, how did he know these things? He was like 17 years old with some of the songs he wrote.
Yeah, I think these days he wrote when he was 17 or something, and he wrote, just wonderful. Doctor My Eyes was very young. He was young when he wrote that. It's just amazing. It's just amazing.
And he's still churning them out. He's still churning them out.
Yeah, I haven't heard his recent stuff, but I've missed his recent stuff. I'll have to go back and revise it all again. But certainly, I've got most of his other albums. So.
Yeah, classics.
Yeah, and they're absolute classics. I absolutely love it. And I was just sent a video of the story to do with Laurel Canyon and everything, you know, all the people who live down there, the birds. And the
yeah, it's a new documentary that's come out.
Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah. It's just wonderful. You should watch it.
I'm looking forward to watching it.
Yeah, it's absolutely stunning. Yeah. So that's summing the whole thing up. It's just been a hell of a journey, really. And it's not finished yet.
No,
so.
It's not. Nabi, tell our listeners where they can find and listen to your music and purchase your music.
Well, it's available on, I think, something like 120 outlets. Whether I'll remember them all, I don't know. It's certainly on Spotify, iTunes, Shazam, Amazon, all the big ones. You can get my stuff. Mm-hmm. If you happen to have an Alexa, whatever they call it. You know, you can just call up my music there.
And you're on Facebook, and you have a website, right? Is it NobbyClark.com?
Yeah, NobbyClarkMusic.com or NobbyClark.com.
Okay.
That's going to be revamped shortly, so that'll be coming down, but it'll be sorted. But yeah, I'm on Facebook. Come and see what's been happening. I did a Facebook show not long ago for to do with the virus and to keep people entertained and occupied.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Go on to my Facebook page and stop in. You can go in there and track down, and you can listen to the daily show that I was doing. It's all still up there. We had something in the region of 70 odd different artists coming in from all over the world and performing little pieces. And I was doing presentations and singing some songs. So, yeah, it's worth coming in for a listen.
Oh, definitely, that sounds awesome.
And also, the book's available on Amazon.
The book's available. Yeah, it's a controversial read, as you know.
Well, life is controversial sometimes.
Well, absolutely, and you can only tell the truth, you know. I had a bit of difficulty when I was preparing to do it, because I knew that some people would get hurt by it, and including my family, and I had to, you know, ask for permission. My daughter said, "Yes, I'm happy that you write it, but I don't want to read it."
Yeah.
And as of now, she hasn't so far. So,
you know, it's a beautiful book. I told you before that, you know, it's very conversational. I felt like you were just telling me your story. You know, it's life. It's ups. It's downs. It's success. It's loss. It's what life's about. And it was really beautifully written.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that, because every word of it was written by me. Of course, it wasn't. There was no ghostwriter involved or anything like that. But I wanted it to be like that. That was the whole design of it. Was the idea was to, when you're reading the book, it should come across like I'm sitting opposite you at the table and telling you the story.
Yes.
You know, that's what it was meant to be, and I'm glad to hear you said it was like that. You know.
Yeah.
I agree with Steve. I did enjoy reading it very much.
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Oh, you're welcome.
Well, yeah. Nobby, thank you so much for sitting with us. This really means a lot to us. I mean, we didn't know any of this stuff in America. We just knew what happened after they landed here. And it's just, you know, a very interesting story. So thank you for sharing it with us.
If we had another couple of hours to spare, I could tell you more, but...
I love it. We'll have to come over...
Thank you so much for all that you did share.
Yeah,
really
thank you.
Appreciate it.
Not at all.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Nobby.
Okay, say hello to everybody for me.
Will do.
All right. Take care.
Okay.
Bye.
Okay, bye now. Bye. Thank you.
And thank you all for listening. We first would like to apologize for the audio for this conversation. It was spotty at best during the recording. Our connection wasn't the best. We lost Nobby a few times, and we had to edit some audio because of that. We're not pros, so we appreciate any and all leeway you afford us. Please also remember that Laura and I, we're not reporters or Bay City Roller historians. We're fans like you. We've just created a platform for our guests to tell their stories and share their memories. Not all stories are going to be rosy. Remember, this is real life, real memories of people who live the stories that we have maybe have been fed incorrectly over the years. Now, if you have any stories or memories that you'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach out to us via the Bay City Roller Fan Events website, which is baycityrollerfanevents.com, or via our Facebook page that you can also reach via the official website. And thank you so much for listening. The feedback has been just tremendous. We're so excited, and we want to keep going as long as people have stories to share. Thank you, thank you, thank you, and keep on rolling.